The U.S. has the largest prison population of any nation. And in the past 3 decades, women have become the fastest growing segment of prisoners, double the rate of men. Between 1980 and 2006, the population of women in prison has jumped 800%, due primarily to the government's war on drugs. The prison system is scrambling to house this influx of incarcerated women. In 2011, the Dayton Correctional Institution became the third women's prison in Ohio when it was changed from a 500-bed male facility to a women's prison that currently houses over 900 inmates. In the next hour, you'll hear a collection of intimate, firsthand accounts from incarcerated women as they talk to each other about the unique struggles female inmates face as Women's Voices from the Dayton Correctional Institution takes you inside the prison.
All right, my name is Amy Wissman, and I'm here at DCI recording a story about basically prison food, but not the food that we get served over the chow hall because we all know that's unedible. This is a story about our recipes and just our ingenuity when it comes to making a limited amount of ingredients, none of them fresh, work. So hopefully I'm going to track some people down in these freezing temperatures to find out their best prison recipe.
Good morning. My name is Michelle Grubbs, and I'm an inmate at the T1 unit. And one of my favorite prison recipes would have to be fat girl wraps. Ooh. They consist of tortilla shells with about 2 ounces of peanut butter. You just spread it evenly on the tortilla shell, and then you add a handful of marshmallows, and then crush up your favorite candy bar, which could be a Snickers, or even if you want to go ahead and do a Swiss roll, whichever you prefer. Okay, you want to fold that in a burrito style, wrap it tightly, and insert it into the microwave for 30 to 45 seconds. When you take it out, be aware, because the filling will be hot. Let it cool for 1 to 2 minutes. And everyone, I have not met one person on the compound or an ORW that does not like this recipe. So if you have any further questions, just contact me at my office. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. You're so silly.
I'm Mandy Mullins, and mine would probably be Hot Pockets, made with saltine crackers, pizza sauce, pepperoni, and all that, and shape them into the form of a Hot Pocket.
I'm not understanding that. You're going to have to break it down for me a little bit.
Well, you just take the saltine crackers and you wet them. And you form your pocket, like in a small bowl or something like that. You put all your toppings inside and then form you a top over, the top of it with another set of crackers. And then you cook it.
But does it actually get crispy?
Yes, and they're good.
My name is Cindy Trabish, 80136, T1, 214. Greens, we make these green bowls with rice and a can of greens and cheese and
chips.
Mm-hmm. It's really good.
That kind of sounds just like mush.
It's good. It's good. It cooks together real good. It is.
What is a scrunchie?
A scrunchie is noodles scrunched up. You can make them hard or make them chewy, and I like mine's chewy. So they're going to be pizza scrunchies. I've been making them for over 10 years, and I'm going to be a millionaire off of them because they're so wonderful. I'm going to start off at the fairs for 3 years, and then I want to take it to the stadiums.
She got a plan.
And after I do the stadiums for like 3 years, then I want to take it to Cedar Point and Kings Island. And after I do that for so many years, I want Disney to buy me out.
Hell yeah. Can you tell us your name?
My name is April Parson.
All right. We'll be looking for your food truck.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Samantha Jack, 78491T1418.
Silly.
Since we're introducing ourselves as inmates. What was I saying? Oh, a break. Okay. I don't really like breaks because there's just a collaboration of everything you get at commissary. You mush it all together and you eat it.
Is it a popular thing to eat?
Yes. Yeah. Everyone knows about it on the outside. Everyone that comes home from prison, they want to make breaks. Yeah.
So a break is just basically everything left over in your refrigerator in a tortilla wrap?
In our box.
No, not in a wrap. Just in a bag. Just mush.
In a bag?
Yeah, just mush.
Yeah, you make them in a bag.
That's mush.
That's prison cuisine, baby.
Yeah. That's prison cuisine, and as Amy pointed out, prison ingenuity. Her recipe for prison orange chicken involves cooking rice in orange pop, then frying it in butter and mayonnaise, all using a microwave.
It's pretty insane, but it is delicious.
That's Amy Wissman, serving an 8-year term. This is Women's Voices from Dayton Correctional Institution on WISO. I'm Lewis Wallace.
And I'm Renee Wild. As part of a Community Voices class, Lewis and I met with 10 women once a week in the chapel at DCI. The women interviewed each other about both personal issues and life behind bars, which, collected together, reflects on the unique challenges of incarcerated life for women. Here are their voices.
My name is Melody Williams.
Hello, my name is Tyra Patterson.
My name is Lana.
I am Nakia Sullivan.
My name is Lachey Landry.
My name is Diana Lynn.
My name is Amy Wisman.
My name is Shannon Evans.
My name is Alicia Federici.
Orzaria Slayton.
So tell me this. How would an average day would have looked like for you?
My day started at 8 p.m. That's when my day started. Call my homeboys, whatever the case may be, like, y'all got any licks for me? You got some money for me? What's it looking like out there? You know, just chop it up with them, trying to get a feel of everything, you know. Homeboys be like, nah, the police out here riding around. You might want to lay low, whatever the case may be. You know, hit swerves off your phone. Like, don't come out here. Okay, like, I was never a block hugger anyway. Pop pills, ecstasy was my drug of choice. I got pregnant with my son when I was 16, and it didn't slow me down any. Like, I slowed down during my pregnancy, but once he was born, I was right back out there.
And what exactly is a block hugger?
A block hugger is somebody that sits out on the block and hustle all day. Like, to me, them is tennis shoe hustlers. Like, they sit out on the block. It's freaking 13 degrees outside, and you out on the block waiting for a fiend to walk up. They in a warm house. What you sitting out on the block for?
So what you saying is you was an expensive, house hugger? Like, what exactly are you saying?
A house hugger. That's cute. The only way I would leave my house to go on the block was if a fiend called me and didn't have a ride or whatever the case may be, and they had enough money that was going to cover my gas there and back and still be able to make a profit.
So what about a mate? Did you have a significant other? And if so, how did they feel? I mean, I wouldn't want my mate out here hitting licks and, you know, waiting on fiends to call and all that. Like, I would be terrified at night. Is the police gonna kick in the door? Like, exactly how was that working in your love life?
Interesting question. I learned to lie very well when it came to that area. My mother didn't even know what I was doing until I got incarcerated. She didn't know half of the details. My daughter's father actually endorsed it. He felt like since he lived in another city, I could help him expand. We can expand together because he knew I was going to do it anyway.
So how did you keep this from your mom? Like, how did she think you were making money? Like,
I think my mother just thought that I was a rebellious teen. Like, the stuff that I would do, like leave home from 13 to 15, she just pictured me as a runaway. You know what I'm saying? Just wanted to be out on the streets and stuff like that. And then when I got pregnant with my son at 16, his father is in the music industry, and he makes a significant amount of money. So I was able to cover up my money with his. You see what I'm saying? So she never really questioned it.
How is your life so different from then to now? Like, what do you dream about and imagine now, being almost, you know, 30?
You know, to be completely honest with you, it's still in me. So I'm just hoping that my career goal of being a motivational speaker and a medical transcriptionist and all of that outweighs and takes away that desire. Like, I hope it consumes me to the point to where I no longer fiend for that type of lifestyle. But at this point, even being incarcerated, like, that's what I know and that's what I was doing. So I haven't done anything else besides that. So it's still there because I don't have the experience of anything else.
Nakia Sullivan, talking to Lachey Landry about her life as a self-described drug kingpin. Nakia was only 13 when she set out to become a kingpin. And by the time she was 15, she had been in 3 shootouts. At 17, she had been stabbed. And in her early 20s, she was shot 3 times. Nakia is serving a 9-year sentence at DCI.
Zaria and the Rabbit. Warning, this story does touch on the theme of child abuse as well as animal abuse.
This is Shannon Evans with WYSO Radio here at Dayton Correctional Institution. I'm here interviewing
Rosaria Slayton. I was one of those kids that was abused and went through the system and was in foster care and group homes. And I grew up and I made something with myself.
Rosaria says she was raised by gangsters, her word, and she shared a lot of really hard things she went through. Before she was put into the foster care system, she spent a lot of time in the custody of a male relative who was very controlling.
Chores in his house was very strict. I had to clean the house 7 times a day, including fluffing pillows, cleaning his room, fetching his towel when he got out of the bathtub, making his bed. He didn't allow me to cook because he was afraid that I would do something to him in his sleep. That's what he would say. And that's probably true. That's probably true because I really hated him. He said I was disturbed, and I kind of believed it, but I felt like he made me disturbed. His daughter gave me a rabbit and because she knew I loved animals, and he seen that I loved that rabbit so much. And I was like 12, and I mean, normally, you know, you do play with baby dolls, but all my toys wasn't important no more because I was so fascinated with this rabbit, and I spoiled it and I dressed it and I fed it and I changed the litter and I had it out more out of the cage than it should have been in the cage, and he hated that. He didn't like that. I didn't do a chore when he told me to, and he said when I came up from getting the laundry in the basement, I came up with the laundry and my rabbit was on my bed. The whites of her eyes was out, and she was panting, and I never seen her pant like this. And I held her, and I knew something was wrong because she was limp. And she died in my arms, and that was really traumatizing for me. And I'm trying not to cry. For me to live that gangster life, as people say, I still have a soft spot for animals. I'm sorry. So he killed my rabbit, and I was really sad about that. And he later cooked it, and he was so mad because I wouldn't eat her. And I mean, that's the worst thing you can do to a kid, I think. I hear stories about girls, you know, growing up on farms and having a pet chicken and whatever. Now I really see what hurt it. But that's just to show you what type of man he was. He was a minister. He allowed a lot of things to happen to me that shouldn't have. I was removed from his care and I was placed into the system, but he was able to still control what happened to me.
How did that make you feel?
It made me feel it made me feel angry.
Rosaria Slayton is serving a 15-year term.
My name is Diana Linz, and I used to rescue dogs. When I grew up, I was very lonely. I only had a dog and a couple of cats. And when I left home, somehow I felt like I needed to take in every animal that I saw. And I was living in a college town, attending college at UC, and I kind of got wrapped up in selling marijuana in order to support my dog habit, my dog rescue habit. I'd say it's a habit. It was, my habit was rescuing the dogs, not necessarily smoking the pot at the time. Everybody wanted weed on Fridays, and then it kind of moved up to selling mushrooms or LSD or whatever it is that I could get, that I could make money on. Once I realized I could make more money selling some harder drugs, that I became addicted to those drugs, and my life had a downward spiral. So I moved out to the country because somebody told me, hey, I'll give you, let you move into this property with two acres and you can have your dogs there. And everything was great, but trouble found me and I just kind of fell into a deeper addiction to cocaine. So now I'm in a dog program here at DCI. It was probably about 4 years before I could finally get in the program. So I have to say that the first couple years, I was an emotional mess. They had me on a lot of meds because I couldn't stop crying. And then even the meds made me cry. And it was just, so the people in that unit are a lot more cheerful and laid back because there's a mellowness and a lightness that comes with being in a unit with a bunch of dogs. And you can't stay angry for long because you can turn around and pet a dog and it takes your anger away right away. It's very therapeutic. I'm learning so much. It's unbelievable. From being able to train a dog to be a service dog, which would be so helpful if I could turn some of these abandoned animals into service dogs. I mean, and possibly even fund my rescue legally, you know, when I get out of here. Because I could never go back to that lifestyle ever again.
Diana was removed from the dog training program shortly after this interview was recorded for some minor infractions. She will have to wait 6 months to reapply. Diana is serving a 14-year sentence at DCI. You're listening to Women's Voices from the Dayton Correctional Institution on WYSO. I'm Renee Wilde. Coming up later in the hour.
I was not a good mom, and you can only say so much. I mean, you know, in a visiting room. For a couple hours, you know, and it's like your heart breaks when they walk out, when you have to watch them walk out that door.
Thanks for tuning in to Women's Voices from the Dayton Correctional Institution. I'm Renee Wilde. Based on WYSO's Community Voices program, Lewis Wallace and I taught radio skills to women inside the DCI prison on the west side of Dayton. The incarcerated women in our class interviewed each other over several months. These are their voices.
I can say, you know, growing up in Chicago, Illinois, in what they call, quote-unquote, the projects, you know, it's pretty rough. You know, I saw in real life and color pimps, prostitutes, drug dealers, drug users. My mom, she loved, early in the morning, she turned on the radio, getting ready for work, getting ready for us to go to school. And back in the day, you know, they had these, we had speakers and albums. She would play albums and put this speaker in our little project apartment complex window and let the little speaker blare for everybody else to hear, and we would be dancing, and you know, so we had to literally like just make, my mom just literally made ourselves have good moments, you know, because most of the time it wasn't a good moment in that environment. So I went to school in Chinatown. And back in them days, you know, the Chinese didn't like the blacks and the blacks didn't like the Chinese. But I had to go to school in Chinatown. So therefore, every day at 2:30, me and my older sister and a few more of our friends, you know, we would brace ourselves because we would literally have to run out of the school building and run all the way through Chinatown to get back across the expressway back to the projects because we were chased by the Chinese gangs. So this was my life. Like, you know,
day in and day out.
In that environment, when you were a child, seeing that you were around gangs and surrounded by negativity, were you ever in a gang?
Yes, I was. I would say when I was maybe about 12, 13, I got lost, into that. And a lot of my friends, they were in gangs. To me, it was like, another family, they looked out for each other, looked out for each other, took care of each other. If somebody messed with one, you had to mess with the whole 20, 30, 40 of them. And, and I have to say, back then, that was intriguing to me. Like, I thought that was what's up. Like I said, when I initially got into the gang, it was all love. So I thought, and when I fell, when I say fell, I mean when I fell victim to drugs, I understand that I hurt them in a way, but I felt like we're supposed to take care of each other. They should have took care of me in that aspect, but instead, when I messed up their money or I messed up their dope, they beat me, they jumped on me, and it got to a point where I got beat so bad that I could have died, but, through the grace of God, I'm still here. And my family, my biological family came together and said, that's not your family. We're your family, and you are going to Columbus, Ohio with your grandmother. Just try to start over.
Did you start over?
I tried. Lord knows I tried. I got a job, was back in church, staying at home with my grandmother, helping her out, because she was up in age, and honestly, she had one of my children, and I was helping her with my child, and I was on the right track. But I learned also that, you can go to Timbuktu trying to get away from drugs. Drugs are in every city, every state, every neighborhood. If you want it, if your body got an itch for it, you can find it. And I learned that when I moved to Columbus, Ohio, got a little itch for it one day, right around the corner. And from there, my life kind of spiraled out of control again.
So you're here in DCI in prison. Mona, from my understanding, which is a touchy subject for anyone that knows you because so many people love you, you have life without parole. Am I correct?
Yes, I do.
What do you do with your time in here?
In the beginning, I would have to say, I kind of got into all of the wrong things. I clicked up with a lot of people. I had a lot of, an entourage of people that I clicked up with who I felt like were my friends. And so I left from the streets like that and came into prison like that, wanting to just a group of people around me. And it was nothing but chaos all the time. Who said, she said, they said, And as I got older in here, I learned that I need to start kind of, picking people off and, and choosing who's good for me, who's good for me.
What is the most significant thing that you have learned in your time of incarceration?
At some point, I'm going to be let down. I'm going to be let down. But I don't have to hold on to that. Because I've let my own family down. I've let my children down. And that is the way I look at it. So even today, when things happen or when I'm disappointed or when I'm angered for that moment, it comes and it goes, because I look to it like who I've let down. I let my father in heaven down. I feel like, I should have been a better person. And though people tell me, this was your life, he had your life mapped out, I have my own belief in that. I don't think he really wanted me to be on drugs and be in gangs and do the things that I've done or commit the crime that I committed to wind up in prison for the rest of my life. I don't believe in that. I don't. But, I know I have disappointed a lot of people. So when people disappoint me, just like my grandmother forgives me, my mother forgives me, my own children forgives me, I forgive. And I keep it going. It's okay, you know.
How many children do you have?
I have four. I have two daughters, and I have two sons. My daughters are the older.
You speak a lot about passion when you talk about your grandma and your kids and your family. If you had a second chance, what would you do? What would you change? Who would you be?
What would I change? The first thing I would definitely change, if I could turn back the hands of time, is be a mom. Because I stripped all of my children from that, you know, and I know that, you know, they don't disrespect me, or, you know, they've never shared no actual like resentment or verbally or anything, but I know in the back of their mind that they hold some resentment because of that. You know, who wants to grow up and can't even say that, you know, my mama coming to my game, my mama coming to pick my report card up? None of my children had that for me, and honestly, I was not a good mom. And you can only say so much. You can only, you know, say so much, I mean, you know, in a visiting room for a couple hours, you know, and then it's like your heart breaks when they walk out, when you have to watch them walk out that door, because, you know, you're like, I failed them, but they can still turn around and say, Ma, I love you.
That's Lana Williams, serving a life sentence at Dayton Correctional Institution.
Many of the incarcerated women struggle with drug addiction. The problem with prescription drugs and heroin has spiked in Ohio over the last few years, and the proportion of women killed by drug overdoses has also gone way up. Out of the 10 women we worked with, there was a schoolteacher, a competitive gymnast, and an artist who were in prison for heroin-related crimes. Here they are talking about their addictions.
Amy, what brought you here?
I'm a heroin addict, and I started using when I was 16, and I'll be 28 next week, so it's been a long journey, I guess, that got me here. You know, at 16, I was just so vibrant and full of life, and, you know, we used to just, like, ride around in cars after school and maybe smoke a little pot and, you know, buy cigarettes from the carryout that sold to underage kids, and, you know, it was like every day was just like the windows were down, the music was blaring, and it just felt good. You know, it was fun to be alive. So, you know, I just kind of started using drugs in a really casual way. But I honestly kind of sought heroin out. And I think a lot of people maybe don't have that story, but I was so passionate about art and writing, and you know, my idols all did heroin, you know. I thought it was going to be, you know, William S. Burroughs or something, or Jack Kerouac if I was a junkie. So for me, it was like a glamorous, you know. People ask me now a lot, like, how I'm going to be involved in this recovery community and, you know, preventing young kids from getting on heroin and stuff. And I think about me at that age, and I'm like, you couldn't have told me anything.
Let me ask you this question. So if somebody would have given you, let's say, a movie of somebody's life and their downhill spiral on drugs, like, let's say heroin, mm-hmm. and you've seen them dope sick and, you know, sores and the lifestyle going spinning out of control, the desperate acts to keep the drug, would that have changed your mind?
You know, if I would have seen a movie about a rock star's, you know, descent into heroin, you know, I don't know that, I think that still would have been romantic and glamorous to me. But maybe if I would have seen, you know, somebody in detox, you know, puking all over themselves, that maybe would have been a little more vivid.
Do you regret the direction that it took?
I definitely think that I wasted a lot of years. And there are things I won't get back, you know, and that sucks. And the reason that I won't use heroin in the future is because ultimately it's just too steep of a price. I'm not willing to pay out all of these
years of misery just for a few, like, really awesome moments. I don't know. I think if I had to do it all over again, I honestly don't know if I would do it differently. And that maybe is, like, a really scary thing to admit.
It's so difficult sometimes to... you want to say you regret a lot of times the things that happened and some of the bad choices that you made, but you know that without those bad choices, you wouldn't be the person that you are right now.
The best thing that prison has done for me is probably taught me to meditate and to find joy in the little things and to appreciate time in a way that I didn't before, because, you know, the only thing I really regret about that decade of dope is that I think I nodded out through all of it, you know, like I have like five memories because I was like gone out of my mind. So that's something I want to do different. I want to remember. In a way, I kind of feel like I'm that 16-year-old kid again, you know, that like when I walk out of these gates, it's going to feel like those car rides used to feel. It's going to be like the windows are rolled down and the stereo's blasting and I'm just driving away into, you know, wide open spaces.
This is Alicia Federici. I'm here at DCI with Shannon
Evans,
and I want to ask her a few questions. What was a day in your life prior to things spiraling out of control, if you will?
I was always really goody-two-shoes kind of girl. I taught Sunday school. I never swore. I was the president of the PTA. We were well off. I grew up out in the country. I was a school teacher, and I never would have thought that I could have ended up in prison. I fell ill and got prescribed painkillers, and after being on those for a year or so, you know, I developed a tolerance to them, and I started taking them more and more until they didn't work, and then I developed a habit, and before I knew it, I was addicted to heroin. I was an addict for 3 years, and I used to think, how is this possible that I am on heroin right now? Because I don't know if it's because I grew up kind of sheltered, maybe, but when I thought of a drug addict, this might sound bad, but I'm going to be honest. When I thought of a drug addict, I thought of, like, you know, some old guy strung out on the side of a building in the city or something. It didn't dawn on me that hit people where I lived. It didn't hit school teachers or Sunday school teachers or PTA moms. You know, that wasn't the face of an addict in my mind. My cousin Doris was not as fortunate as I was growing up. She was raised by my aunt in the city with three siblings, and they, you know, were on welfare. And I remember my mom taking her into our home out in the country when she was a teenager and us trying to give her, like, a second chance at life. And I remember her being very angry and always, like, dabbling in drugs. And I always couldn't understand, like, why would you want to do drugs? Like, why didn't you just come to church with me? She was only a couple years younger than me, and I always, like, felt myself trying to take her under my wing. She did 5 months in county jail, and she got out, and she used, and she overdosed and left four kids without a mom. And I remember being at her wake and seeing her in the casket and thinking, that could have been me, and I hope I didn't fail her in this last year or two that I became an addict, because I knew she looked up to me. And then I found myself being very depressed, because you have no control over your addiction when you're in the midst of it. And I remember that I got high right before her wake. So I was at her wake feeling very guilty about that. Like, how dare I could do that when this is what just took her out and left four kids without a mom. That makes me sad, that part of it. And another part of that makes me feel like, thank God I was given a second chance. And this might sound silly, but I'm grateful to be in prison right now, because I feel like if I wasn't in prison, I would probably be dead. And then my children would not have their mother, all because of an addiction that I had the power within me to beat. And I just didn't know that I had the power within me to beat. And I've reconciled the fact that I'll never be a school teacher again, which I actually had to mourn that loss. The beginning of September, the end of August this year, I found myself in my cell on my bed crying, thinking, I'll never hear Miss Evans, can you tie my shoe? Miss Evans, you took my lunchbox, or smell sharpened pencils first thing in the morning. Or I know that might sound a silly thing to grieve, but I grieved being a school teacher, and because I knew that that probably would never be an option for me again.
Shannon, I want to ask you, what is your family's reaction to your incarceration?
I think my mom was kind of shocked, but also an interesting thing she said to me, which came out of absolutely nowhere. A couple weeks ago, I was on the phone with her, and she was crying, and then she started telling me about how when she was a little girl, you know, she went to see my grandpa in prison. He was the getaway driver when his friends knocked over a convenience store. A Piggly Wiggly, actually, is what they were called. But my grandfather was in a prison in West Virginia when my mom was like 2 years old. And my grandma took my mom to go visit him. And they were driving down a windy country road, old Route 250 in West Virginia. And it was a dark, rainy, dreary fall day. And, you know, back then, people didn't wear seatbelts. And my mom was sitting in the front seat as, like, a little toddler. But my grandma slid and went off the road. And my mom and my grandma both actually went through the windshield. She almost lost all of her sight in one of her eyes and her right eye. And my grandma lost all of her sight in her left eye. So there's this picture, this old black and white picture of my mom as a little 2 or 3 year old, little blonde-headed girl with, you know, white bandage all wrapped around her head. She stayed in the hospital for months, but my mom said she remembers my grandpa being brought in handcuffs and, you know, leg chains, a guard bringing him in, and he brought her a teddy bear. And my mom said that, you know, during her whole life, that's the only time she ever seen my grandpa cry. I remember my mom saying to me, "What I think about now, Shannon, is that, you know, I can't believe that you're in prison. And it was really difficult for me to drive 3 hours to come and visit you in prison." She said, "I didn't even think that I would, you know, think about when I was little or going to see my dad in prison and how that day changed her life forever." Now she's an adult going to see her daughter in prison. She said, "I had this, like, really sickening feeling in my stomach the whole way visiting you." Oftentimes in life, I think about how things come full circle. So as far as my being in prison and how my family feels about it, it's actually much deeper than just she's in prison and we miss her.
You're listening to Women's Voices from the Dayton Correctional Institution on WYSO. I'm Renee Wild. Coming up after the break,
they assigned me and another young lady that was half my age, she was 25, a cell, and they told us to go in there, and we went in and they closed the door and told us we would not come back out until the next day. So we were literally locked down for 21 hours a day.
This is Women's Voices from the Dayton Correctional Institution on WYSO. I'm Renee Wild. These interviews were recorded by women incarcerated in the Dayton Prison, one of three women's prisons in Ohio. Lewis Wallace and I met up weekly with the women
to talk about interviewing techniques and to help record conversations between themselves. The result is an intimate, firsthand look at life in prison.
When you came here, Melody, was it different circumstances than the housing unit you're living in now?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I remember being in receiving. When you first get off the bus, you go through a receiving process, and then they decide, based on your security level, where they're going to place you in the institution. And based on my charges, I'm a lifer. I have 59 years to life. So I was sent to a supermax maximum institution. I remember going into the security housing unit, and they assigned me and another young lady that was half my age. She was 25, a cell. And they told us to go in there, and we went in, and they closed the door and told us we would not come back out until the next day. So we were literally locked down for 21 hours a day. I had the most amazing, beautiful little bunky, and I miss her dearly, and I'm praying that everything is going well with her. She went home. We cried together. We sang together. We danced together. We tried to find joy in the little things, like the birds chirping in the window in the early in the mornings. I never believed I would be in isolation like that. I did that for almost 2 years. I never made it past the compound mailboxes. I gained 50 pounds sitting on the side of the bed. Our only guilty pleasure was food, so we ate. We ate cookies and chips and drank pop and things I never really indulged in at home. But they made us feel good. Later on, we were allowed to get TV so we could watch the videos, and we would sing to the videos and memorize the words and watch a lot of movies. That helped us get through, too. I think that was my worst nightmare.
The day that they told you they were moving you out of that unit and raising your security level and that you would be moving to a different unit and receiving more privileges, can you describe the feeling you had?
I wanted to go outside. They have a big walk jog, and you can see it from your cell when you're locked down. My dream was to be able to walk that walk jog in the sunshine.
The day you were able to do that, did you cry happy tears?
I don't remember whether or not I cried, but I felt free. I felt free behind barbed wire and a double fence. But I felt free. I felt free because the sun was on my face.
Melody Williams is serving a life sentence. She was interviewed here by Shannon Evans.
Kids are an invisible presence at DCI. One national survey finds more than 2% of white children have multiple family members in prison. That jumps to 16% for black children. And parenting came up a lot during our Community Voices class at the prison. Here's an interview between two mothers.
My name is Nakia Sullivan, and I'm at Dayton Correctional Institution with LaShay Landry. How you doing today, Shay?
I'm okay. It's nice and cold outside with a lot of snow, so it's as good as it's going to get. Before coming to prison, I was young, still doing young-minded things. Even though I was a mother, it was like how you're a little girl and you play house and you got this baby doll and, you know, you have a boyfriend, girlfriend, and whatever. It was like I was doing that, but I was grown. I didn't know what my future looked like, honestly. Like, I didn't have any dreams or goals or any plans on where I was headed.
You mentioned that you have a daughter. How did that change your life or your thinking?
Wow. Well, when I was 17, I found out I was pregnant 2 weeks before my 18th birthday. When I found out I was pregnant, I was like, no, I'm not having this baby. Like, I was totally against it. My mom couldn't change my mind, my boyfriend, neither one of my best friends. And I don't know, I met a girl, and for some reason it was like her words was gold or something. She was the one person who made me look at it in a different perspective. she promised me that if I had my daughter, she would be there for me always. So I kind of took a chance on that. And it's kind of crazy because the one thing that I didn't want is the one thing that keep me sane during this prison time. So it's just like how stuff really, for real, come full circle.
So you had a lot of mixed emotions throughout your pregnancy. How did you deal with them?
Everybody loved on me. Everybody did everything for me. My mom, she went over and beyond. Like, I can remember for Christmas, you know, my mom is real big on Christmas. It's always 1,000 gifts underneath the tree because there's so many kids. But I can remember having the most gifts underneath the tree, and I was so excited. Like, yes, I'm about to open all this stuff. Like, I'm getting special treatment because I'm pregnant. No, I opened up all these gifts. It was so many baby clothes, baby everything. And it still didn't dawn on me that I was going to be a mom. Like, it just didn't click. I felt like the world was closing in on me because I realized it wasn't about to be about me no more. It was about to be about me and a baby. Like, I don't know. It was a hard pill to swallow, but I think everybody kept me excited because they were so excited about me being a mom. Like, I thought, you know how when you're pregnant and you're young, people kind of frown upon it or have negative things to say. I never, not one time, got any of that. Everybody was so proud of me. I guess because I was the only one in the family who had a baby at 18. So it was like, yes, she made it to the finish line. She waited till she's grown. So I don't know. They were a good support system.
Can you recall the first thought that you had looking at your daughter?
First of all, I had her 2.5 months early. So they had me on a morphine drip, preparing me for the cesarean. And when I say after I had her, I was so high off this morphine. I don't know. That is a outrageous high that I never want to feel ever again in life. But all I know is when we went to the newborn intensive care unit, they put her in my arm. And she, mind you, she was 3 pounds, 13 ounces. She was so tiny. I felt like I was holding nothing. And all I remember is saying, can somebody please grab her? Because I feel like I'm about to drop her, because it felt like I was holding air. And I remember my girlfriend looking down at me like, if you drop her, I'm going to drop you.
How old is your daughter now?
She'll be 9 on the 31st of this month. She's so big. It's just crazy how one day I was thinking about getting rid of her, and now today and every day, she's the only thing I wake up thinking about.
Lashay Landry, who's incarcerated at the Dayton Correctional Institution, interviewed by fellow prisoner Nakia Sullivan. A couple of times, our students were able to take recording kits out into the yard and open areas, like the commissary and the library.
Here's one of our incarcerated students.
Tyra Patterson, I'm with WYSO, and I want to ask this fine officer about our feral cat named Fancy, which he seems to think that the cat's name is
Sylvester.
Why do you call Fancy Sylvester, sir?
Because it was named by the officers years ago before this so-called owner took charge of the cat.
I am the so-called owner, and I called her Fancy, and you know I'm in love with that cat. So how come the institution don't help me pay for this food if you all raised her?
From what I've seen, the cat has a little boyfriend on the outs.
Well, would you please start calling her by her real name, sir?
Sure.
What's her name?
Sylvester.
Oh, we're still fighting over it. Thank you.
Another incarcerated woman, Amy Wisman, used to see Tyra sneaking around the yard, leaving little dishes of food in the bushes for Fancy the cat.
Why is she named Fancy?
Because she's black and white, and she's fancy to me. Like, she wears this coat, and it's like a tuxedo, so I call her Fancy.
Now, you say feral cat. Like, what exactly does that mean?
That means that she doesn't trust anyone and that she's left in a cold by herself and no one feeds her. So she has to fend for herself. So she's a survivor on her own.
So it seems like you and Fancy kind of relate to each other.
It took 2 years for me to get that cat to come to me. First, she was so mean because, of course, she was abused. She has a broken back, and a lot of people thrown rocks at her and be really mean to her. So I would feed her really nice food like tuna, oysters, and salmon and stuff like that. But then I gave her this name, and I would say it like, Fancy. Now,
She literally comes up to me and meows for me, and people comes in the unit and say, "Tyra, your cat is outside," and I love her. I'm like in love with this cat. I tell her my secrets. You know, in prison, you don't have anyone to trust, and you can't talk to anyone because your stories get misconstrued, or, you know, people make their own stories out of your story. So with my cat, Miss Fancy, I tell her anything in the world, and you bet to know it goes nowhere. I love her. She means the world to me.
Oh my God, you're literally tearing up over Fancy. I love it. What is the ultimate goal for you and Fancy? Like, you know, what do you want? Where is this relationship going?
My ultimate goal is to go home and have the animal shelter come back inside this prison and capture her and give her shots and then put her inside my home. And then I have that same bowl or that same smell of food and my voice to welcome her into a home and leave the door open so she can come and go so she don't feel captured.
Tyra Patterson is currently waiting to hear from Governor John Kasich about her request for clemency. When we first met Alicia Federici at DCI last winter, she had been in prison for about 6 months on charges related to heroin addiction. Shortly after our course ended, Alicia left prison, and she quickly fell back into heroin use. We learned from her family that 3 weeks after her release, Alicia died of an overdose.
In an interview with another incarcerated woman, Shannon Evans, Alicia had talked about her struggle with drugs.
I grew up in a very well-established family, Italians, of course, so very loud and rambunctious, and I had a twin sister who is also the very most interesting character, I suppose, of my life, and partner in crime, you could say, best friend. She's definitely my other half, that's for sure. But, you know, I was immersed directly into sports, gymnastics, being my whole entire life for about 17 years from the time I was 3 till I was 19. And I climbed very high in the levels there, you could say. And so then all of a sudden I had trained a little too hard and broke my back. So I became dependent on pain pills that I was prescribed. And of course, in high school, I missed out on all of the glory days, you could say. And so, but my twin didn't. So when, you know, Alicia had downtime, then Ashley was the one, you know, "Hey, do this, try it like this. Hey, maybe we could do this with this," you know. And so, of course, me being, you know, naive to the life at the time, was gung-ho about it. We were, you know, 100 miles per hour, hit the ground running. And so risk-taking, I suppose, was a lead factor in the heroin epidemic of my life, I suppose.
Did anybody ever warn you when you were in your addiction deep that, you know, it was either prison or death? Did you ever hear that terminology?
I feel that, yes, I did hear it. Honestly, I did. Did I choose to believe it or understand it? No, I definitely chose to ignore. My twin actually said to me, and I'll never forget, she said, "If you try this, you're going to love it, and you're never going to stop." And that's exactly how it happened. That's exactly how it happened. I was definitely forewarned by somebody who was currently, you know, in the midst of addiction. And this was, like, right on the cusp, you know, right before you start. But it was still like, let's do it. So I feel like risk-taking was kind of like, you know, going from I'm not afraid to do double backflips on this, you know, 4-inch wide beam to, you know, I really don't care what this is going to do to me. And I feel like it was a giant factor in why I was not afraid to just stick a needle in my arm and go for it. So.
May I ask how long you were an addict?
I've been an addict prior to prison for the past, you know, 4 years, four years. Yeah.
Wow. Have you ever been to any rehab facilities before prison?
Yes, I have. We tried the whole rehab thing 3 times, actually. I've been to one community-based correctional facility twice, and completed both times, you know. I don't know if consciously I was faking it to make it, but subconsciously, you know, there was still a reserve there, but nothing has seemed to really make an impact as much as this.
You feel the difference this time is that you have a made-up mind and you didn't before, you weren't taking it seriously, or this time you're taking it more seriously because of your circumstances?
I think that's a good question because I think about that a lot. Being an addict is kind of, I want to cover my ground before I get there type deal. But a lot of the time I have to sink my own ship to realize that I want it to still be floating, and you really don't know what you got until it's gone type deal. And I think that those are the lessons that you know, cut deep with me, if you will, because you know, they're the hardest ones to grasp, you know, and you have to live through it. You have to live through it. And I think that's my biggest thing.
Alicia Rose Federici died on Easter Sunday. She had just turned 26.
My name is Lana Williams, and I am basically interviewing myself today. The other young ladies here are all interviewing one another, and it's okay. I enjoy talking to myself, so I think I'll just sit over here and kind of express how I'm feeling today and where I'm at today. In a place like this, incarcerated, you know, you go through emotional roller coaster rides. You know, some days I can go through a day with like a breeze. Almost like, you know, I'm at home. Literally, free, at home, without a care in the world. But then there are other times when I feel really exactly what this place is sought out to make you feel like, and that is closed in, away from everyone and everybody. And today just happens to be one of them days. I don't look for pity parties, so, you know, I keep a lot of stuff held in. And I've been told that's not okay. It's not good to do that. But it works for me. You know, it works for me because you have to kind of figure out your own way of dealing and maintaining in a place like this without losing your mind or becoming so depressed and sad that you literally want to give up life itself, which I have seen throughout the years. But you know, I keep the faith and I hold on. I hold on to hope that one day I will be released from here.
Lana Williams is serving a life sentence. You've been listening to Women's Voices from the Dayton Correctional Institution. These interviews were produced at public radio station WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio, as part of their Community Voices training program. This documentary hour was produced by me, Community Voices producer Renee Wild. The interviews were mixed by myself and former WYSO managing editor Lewis Wallace, with editorial input from WYSO general manager Nina Ellis. This hour is dedicated to the memory of Alicia Federici.